the digital surveillance economy meets a potential criminalizing of abortion if the landmark Roe v. Wade is overturned. And now people are wondering whether a person's data trail could be treated as evidence. We're talking about digital privacy on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We leave our digital footprint wherever we roam online, whether we're shopping or surfing or scrolling through social media, posting. Groups like the Digital Defense Fund have created tip sheets for abortion-related digital privacy. Join in with questions on privacy, on browsing, on tracking. 800-642-1234. Alan Butler is Executive Director and President of the Electronic Privacy Information Center based in Washington, D.C. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So as you watch this national conversation take shape around digital privacy protections and what could happen if Roe is overturned, what are some really key things you're thinking about? What's coming up as you see this unfold in America?
Well, we're really thinking about the risk that the types of data that are routinely collected about users online could be essentially weaponized against our most vulnerable population if states decide to go after individuals for seeking or assisting others to seek abortions and make reproductive choices.
What is that risk like? How valid are these concerns that privacy rights advocates are really speaking out about?
I mean, I think the concerns are really significant because the reality is we don't have substantial privacy protections in the U.S. right now for data that is collected about and accessible about us online. And in particular, if you think about categories of data that reveal a great deal about where we go, what we're doing, what we're looking for, what we're thinking. These are data like the history of the location of our cell phones, our mobile devices, or data about what we're searching for online, or even data that others, like data brokers and advertisers, create about us, like the categories that we're placed into from the perspective of, you know, marketing goods and services.
Mm-hmm. What rights are in place for how personal data may be distributed? What rights do we have?
Well, here in the United States, we have a number of types of privacy rights historically at the state level, a few at the federal level, but what we really lack is a comprehensive federal privacy law that covers data collected by internet platforms and websites. Our privacy laws in the U.S. at the federal level haven't been updated substantially since the late 1990s. And the privacy laws specifically governing law enforcement access to our communications and other data haven't been substantially updated since the early 1990s. So there really are no modern federal laws that cover these types of data.
Very behind there in the realities that people face today with these platforms they use. I'm wondering, you know we have our digital footprints out there, but for how long is that footprint visible? How long is my data retained in all these different places and that trail? Is it a forever footprint?
Yeah, I mean, one of the scariest things about this is that there's so much that we don't know, right? Because there's no formal law in place that requires companies to reveal how long they're retaining data. We don't know, for example, how long, how many years every single phone company keeps logs of the location of your cell phone, right? And there's also, so we don't know how many different entities have access to that information, right? So if we just think about the cell phone, again, as a specific example, you know, the phone company knows which towers your phone is connected to because it has to deliver your calls and your messages. But it does keep a log of that information. We don't know for every phone company exactly how long. But then there's all of the apps that you use on your phone, right? So your phone has advanced technology that allows you to pinpoint your location if you're using maps, if you're using weather. But it turns out that lots of apps want to collect that location data for other reasons, a lot of it for targeted advertising. And you don't even necessarily know which entities, which businesses are out there collecting your data and then transferring it to others.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about concerns over how personal data could be used to enforce anti-abortion laws with Alan Butler. He's Executive Director, President of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. You can join in on data privacy questions you have, 800-642-1234. Alan, you touch on their location data, marketing and advertisers certainly using that, but walk us through how a law enforcement agency could get a hold of this kind of information, this kind of location data, and use it.
Sure. So law enforcement has been increasingly using location data in all levels of criminal investigations over the last 20 years, and even before then. But I think with increasing ease. Now, there was a significant sort of progress a few years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Carpenter. There, the Supreme Court held that law enforcement, if they are trying to force a telephone company, for example, to provide a log of someone's location over time, like a month worth of location data, they have to get a warrant. Mm-hmm. And in order to get a warrant, they have to provide probable cause to a judge to show that what they're seeking to obtain is likely evidence of a crime. Now, the problem when we think about the overturning of Roe and the criminalizing of abortion is that these states are making these activities a crime, right? And so law enforcement, in the case where they're, for example, trying to find information about all the people that are going to a clinic or a specific person's, travel history that they suspect has gone to a clinic, is going to basically argue in the warrant that they believe the location data will show that the person sought an abortion. And with respect to a warrant, like that's the protection that is provided by a warrant, is just the protection that what law enforcement is looking for is related to a crime.
But wouldn't law enforcement still need probable cause to search someone's phone unless the owner consented?
So the issue with these types of data is that they're not held on the phone.
Okay.
Right. So these types of data are held by third parties. They're held by the phone company, or they're held by an app company, or they're held by a data broker.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the phone company, under the Carpenter decision from a few years ago that I mentioned, law enforcement at least has to get a warrant. They have to prove to a court that what they're seeking is evidence of a crime. But once they do that, then the phone company is required to provide that data. And we've seen other situations over the past few years where at least, at the federal level and in other contexts, law enforcement has begun to buy data on the open market where it is available from data brokers.
Do we consumers have any right to deletion? If I make a request to have my data deleted by a company, would they respond to that? Would they follow through? Could I do that?
So in the last 5 years, we've seen positive development in privacy law with the passage of the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, with the passage of certain privacy laws here at the state level in the U.S., including California and Colorado. And a number of those laws do provide a deletion right. But that right is not universal, is not comprehensive in the United States right now. So a company may comply with that request, even if you don't live in one of those states or jurisdictions, but they're not currently required to.
Alan Butler with us leads the Electronic Privacy Information Center digital rights organization based in Washington. Join in on your digital privacy concerns, your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Alan Butler here on the Ideas Network. How do you keep your data private? What happens in a post-Roe America where abortion would become criminalized? We're at the intersection of privacy and technology with the Electronic Privacy Information Center on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the fact is, we expose our personal details when we browse the web, we Google something, we use apps. There's also location data to consider. We've been talking about your cell phone settings. Join in on data privacy in light of Roe, 800-642-1234. Alan Butler is president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center with us for the hour. Alan, digital rights advocates are concerned data from search engines like Google could be used as evidence by law enforcement. Is there precedent here for using your search history data?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, with search history, the traditional protections that already exist, I think are a little bit better suited in the sense that the law protects the content of your communication. But again, the requirement is to get a warrant. And as we've talked about before, the warrant requirement doesn't really help individuals who are subject to expansive criminal laws that are criminalizing their private behavior. So I think really this moment post Roe is making is a lot of people realize and rethink, you know, how substantial these protections are, you know, when that data exists. I think as long as that data exists, it's potentially accessible by law enforcement if they're, you know, enforcing a criminal statute.
Can you explain how geofence warrants work? Because these warrants are really gaining some traction. Law enforcement alleged crimes. How do they work?
Sure. So we talked before a bit about location data. You're thinking about, you know, an individual's cell phone and where that phone has been over 30 days. The geofence warrant kind of flips that around, and instead, law enforcement will go to a phone company or even potentially a company like Google and say, we want you to tell us information about every device that was near a specific location at a specific time, right? Mm. So they could pinpoint, you know, some examples that have been used in the past in the real world, like a bank robbery or something, right? They want to know what devices were inside this bank at the time it was robbed. But you could just as easily, again, in the context of post-Roe criminalizing abortion, say, oh, we're just going to draw a geofence around a clinic and see who went in. So that's something that already happens. And there's some debate around what exactly the rules and limitations should be about when that technique can be used. But whatever the protections are, they're going to center around this question of, is there probable cause to believe a crime was committed?
What does your organization think about what rules and regulations should be put around geofencing?
I think geofencing is a really invasive tool that goes pretty far beyond what we traditionally think of as a kind of standard law enforcement role. And it really should require, I think, heightened protection versus, you know, kind of a traditional, you know, warrant search of a house or a device, but I think at least a warrant is necessary, and potentially some additional protections about non-pertinent data, right? Because the issue with a geofence warrant is that you're collecting data about a bunch of unknown individuals.
Yes.
Unlike a traditional warrant where you're saying, okay, this is a suspect. We believe that they have evidence of a crime. We're going to search their device. Then we're going to describe to the court what we found and whether it's relevant. With a geofence warrant, you're saying we're going to essentially vacuum up a bunch of data about people who we don't know who they are in advance. And then what's going to happen with that data, right? Is it going to be stored and used for other investigations? Is it going to be deleted? I think there needs to be more resolved about that. And frankly, I think those protections need to be statutory. I don't think the courts are really equipped to deal with that problem.
Or perhaps shared with other law enforcement agencies or, you know, a bank of agencies if it's collected somewhere that can be accessed through, you know, a larger system.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we don't know. Typically, the government's law enforcement's perspective is once they have information, unless there's special protections attached to it, it's fair game, right? It's already in the possession of the government, and it can be transferred and shared across government agencies.
Saul from Stevens Point emailed to ask about U.S. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has introduced two privacy bills that Saul says have gone nowhere, and wonders how Wyden's bills relate to the goals of your center and what you want to advance.
Absolutely. I think that there's a number of really strong proposals in the Senate. One of them is the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. And this gets at an issue that I was discussing earlier, which is that we increasingly see agencies and law enforcement and other entities going out and essentially buying data from data brokers, right? And this is where the lack of commercial data privacy protections bleeds over into law enforcement. And you can see situations where law enforcement, can't satisfy the warrant requirement and essentially does an end run around it by buying the data from a broker. And this is the type of thing that would be restricted by the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act.
Why isn't it getting traction on Capitol Hill? What is holding it back?
It's a really good question. What is holding it back? Well, it's tough to get any bill passed in the federal Congress right now, but it certainly feels like this is the moment for privacy legislation. We hope that the bills that are being debated around commercial data practices will be taken up soon. With respect to the kind of law enforcement side, and there hasn't been a lot of movement in the Judiciary Committee on those issues. And, it's not exactly clear what the sticking point is. There's not been a lot of public debate. I mean, we hope for these committees to have a markup, to have a robust public debate, to give voice to these issues. And we certainly applaud, Senator Wyden and others who have introduced legislation that would actually get at the problem.
Alan Butler with us of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, guiding us through the scope and value of our digital footprint as we talk about digital privacy this hour. Taking your questions along the way, 800-642-1234. Looking more also at efforts in the states, there has been efforts to compensate users for their data. California Governor Gavin Newsom proposed that tech companies should pay people for their personal data. What do you think of that initiative?
I think the push in times for kind of the propertization or the monetization of data is very concerning to me because it seeks to turn personal data into a commodity. And if you go back in the history of privacy law in the United States to really the kind of dawn of modern privacy law in the late 1800s, when Louis Brandeis, former Supreme Court justice, wrote The Right to Privacy, a famous law review article that really laid out this issue of privacy, it really distinguished privacy from a property right? Because the purpose of the law is not to increase the kind of use and monetary value of that data. And the problem with propertizing and sort of monetizing data is that it encourages further data collection, right? And further data use and analysis, which is really, I don't think, the direction that we need to go.
But you can't deny that there is this incredible gold mine of a data industry here, just feeding off of people's personal data. So, you can't exactly, you have to acknowledge that as well. So how do how do you balance that between not wanting to make it a commodity and yet cracking this industry that is certainly a gold mine for so many companies?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we need is we need laws and regulations that impose real restrictions and real responsibilities on the companies that are collecting and handling this data, right? I think that it has to enshrine that privacy is a right that needs to be protected, that companies that collect data, yes, they may be using it in ways that generate profit for them, but they need to, as a result, take on the responsibilities to ensure that that data is not misused, that that data is not transferred without outside an individual's control. Like, the companies are entitled to make a profit, but they have to do so in a responsible way.
How seriously do they take this issue, do you think, as you look across the landscape of businesses? How big of an issue is this?
I think it's a massive issue in the industry as it is for us in civil society. And part of the reason is because, as I mentioned, of the new laws that have been passed, right? We haven't yet been successful at getting a law here in the US at the federal level, but we have, you know, the European GDPR that passed in 2018. We have a California privacy bill that's, you know, rolling out over the next few years. We have bills in Colorado and several other states. Businesses know that, you know, more and more businesses now handle and deal with personal data. And it's a major part of their, you know, internal operations, their business plan, their legal compliance.
And their ethics. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Alan Butler leads the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the nonprofit digital rights advocacy group. Join in on surveillance, location data, information, apps reveal, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Alan Butler. Stay with us after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the right to privacy in healthcare and beyond on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The initiative called United for Privacy, it includes technology trade groups, says at least 37 states have introduced or passed their own privacy bills regulating the collection and use of personal data. They don't like this patchwork approach and would favor a federal privacy law instead. Join in on digital advocacy on privacy laws, 800-642-1234. We have Alan Butler, president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, with us for the hour. Let's bring on a caller now. Karen is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Karen. What do you want to bring up?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested in this issue, and I've certainly heard it framed from the perspective of women's privacy in relation to, you know, this new state of affairs with digital security. But I also wonder if, you know, because men don't tend to take women's rights as seriously because it doesn't affect them, or it may even benefit them to have, you know, fewer women in the workforce or whatnot. I'm wondering if it's helpful to also talk about how these privacy risks could impact men. For example, the fencing technology that he talked about just a few minutes ago, couldn't that also be used to identify paternity? And, you know, if we had a different world that, you know, thought about, you know, not only mandating forced birth, but saying that people responsible for creating that pregnancy also have financial, you know, responsibilities and you know, pull that data in and force people to have their wages garnered or something like that.
Karen, thinking about paternity here. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the potential use, you know, location data, search data, ad targeting data are really myriad, and it's right to think in terms of how does this affect every single person in their own way, right? There are lots of potential scary uses of this data, that, and every opportunity to highlight that, I think, underscores the need for real privacy protections in the United States. I think one thing that's, you know, somewhat related to that question that really troubles me is the emergence in Texas of, you know, the essential civil bounty law, right, where individuals can on their own go out and sue other people for, you know, participating in or being involved in some way in an abortion. And beyond law enforcement access, that opens the kind of can of worms of people seeking data through, you know, individual civil discovery in cases. And that is really kind of a terrifying proposition to have essentially vigilantes out there trying to get access to all this data for potential lawsuits.
Is that taking off anywhere else? Do you see that getting traction?
Texas has been kind of that's really the Texas model. And I don't know that we've seen clones of that bill yet, but given its prominence and given sort of the fact that before this draft Dobbs opinion, that there was not any success in blocking it. I wouldn't be surprised if other states that are considering restrictive abortion rules thought about following that trend.
Karen, thank you for the call. We also heard from Nina in Colgate, sent us an email our way and says, data privacy exists when you use the internet computers at a public library. Your library card number is not tied to the sites that you visit. And even the fact that a library card or guest card use the library computers is scrubbed frequently. And your local public library and librarian, Nina says, is a great resource for many things. All you have to do is ask. What about using, using library computers and more public venues like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's a lot of there's a deep history in the privacy space with involving libraries and librarians. Libraries have been one of the few institutions in the United States that have really gone to bat for people to protect their privacy. And I think part of it has to do with their role as a community resource, right? And then their role in connecting people and providing people with information, and their understanding that protecting confidentiality and privacy of what people are reading and what they're thinking is really critically important. So I'm really glad that privacies can be a resource. I think that the reality is that the kind of surveillance architecture of the internet has reached such a epic scale that it is really difficult for the average person to navigate and avoid it, right? There's lots of things that people do to try to limit the data that's collected about them. They, you know, might use privacy protective browsers, or they might use, you know, VPNs or adjust the settings on their phones or their services. But it's really difficult to not get caught in the net at some point. And I think that's why really the onus needs to be on the companies to minimize the data that they're collecting, right? To limit it to data that's actually needed for the services they're providing to individuals, and not simply track and profile people whenever they want.
Ellen, you mentioned these privacy-focused browsers, and I'll name names, you know, brands like DuckDuckGo or Firefox Focus that do not apparently save search data or collect personal information or allow the, you know, third-party trackers. Is that true? Do these help?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there are a lot of technologies and services out there that do help, right? Brave is another example of a browser that really is designed with kind of a privacy-first mentality. And there are a lot of things that can be done at the software level, at the hardware level, to limit the data that's ever transferred to websites. And so that certainly helps blocking third-party cookies. We hope with the rollout of some of these new laws in the states that there will be development and deployment of a very easy opt-out technique for to stop a lot of the tracking online. One iteration of this is called the global privacy control that could actually be applied across different browsers and services. But it's a really complicated problem because you can, again, control that. You can try to control as much as you can in one moment, in one instance, but people access the web and services across so many different devices, right? You're on your laptop, you're on your phone, you're on your tablet or other device. That can, getting a handle on all of it, again, is really difficult. And it's why I think the onus needs to be on the data collectors and not put all the responsibility on the individual internet users.
Discussing this complex web, this complex world of digital privacy law with Alan Butler, president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Join in with your questions on privacy laws, what questions you have about how this intersects with Roe, 800-642-1234. Ellen, you know, I know I'm not alone, but I'm busy. I don't read privacy notices, privacy policies that get updated, get sent to me, you know, by the places that intersect my life with the larger economy and the larger world. If I did read them instead of just complying and checking the box, what might I notice?
You know, it really depends on the company at this point. There's been, you know, some positive development in the last few years in companies actually writing policies that are in plain English that are actually comprehensible, right? The tradition for a long time was that these terms of service, these privacy policies were, you know, written in legalese and were hundreds of pages long, right? They're a sophisticated business contract. The average user doesn't glean anything from reading them. And the amount, and there have been studies done that measure the amount of time it would take the average user to read all the terms of service for all the services they use. And it's basically like the you know, heat death of the universe or something. You just can't do it. But as I said, there's been some positive developments. You know, one interesting development in the last few years has been the effort by Apple to impose sort of coding and transparency requirements for app practices, right? Called app tracking transparency, so that business app providers actually have to describe in clear terms that can fit in the app store window what data they're collecting and how. And there's other situations like that where there's been positive evolution in empowering users to take some control. Again, I don't think that the impetus should all be on users, but the settings on Apple's iOS that, you know, control when and how location services are used have definitely improved over the years. But what would the average person glean from reading these terms of service? If they're good, well-written, comprehensible, at least that person would understand hopefully what types of data that service or app is collecting. And like you mentioned earlier in the discussion, how long that data is retained, how that data can be accessed or deleted, and where that data flows beyond that app.
So you'll glean this knowledge and yet you'll still comply. You still want to use whatever service this is or whatever other product this is. So you, the trade-off there is if you're going to use it, you're going to have to still comply to some extent.
Right. And this is the fundamental flaw in the approach that we took in the US to privacy for many years or prior really to the rollout of these recent state laws, which was that this kind of notice and choice approach where there was an assumption that was, you know, explicit in the late 90s in some of the studies by the Federal Trade Commission that, oh, adults are, you know, they know how to make choices about what they do online and they can basically read the privacy policy and decide whether or not to use the website. Reality is that's not realistic, right? People don't have the time to read the policies, one, and two, they have no ability to change the practices even if they do read the policies. Mm. So that's why the shift now is to, you know, empowering users with rights to their data, right? Rights to access their data, correct it if it's wrong, have it deleted, and also imposing on the businesses real obligations and restrictions about what data they collect and how they use that data, rather than pretending that somehow users reading privacy policies is going to change things.
Alan Butler heads the Electronic Privacy Information Center, our guide to the future of privacy policy, privacy litigation, where our country goes from here. Still time to talk about your privacy protections, the potential spillover effect if Roe is overturned. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alan Butler here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the future of digital privacy as it becomes this flashpoint issue with the High Court weighing whether to overturn Roe and to criminalize abortion in America. Groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation recently published digital security and privacy tips for people involved in abortion access. Still time to talk about digital privacy. 800-642-1234. Alan Butler is president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center with us for about 9 more minutes. Alan, you've been exploring how the pandemic has led to more data collection and surveillance systems. How are surveillance systems expanding, changing in these times?
Well, there's been a lot of different changes that we've seen over the last few years, obviously, in our lives. And many of those have centered around remote work, remote school, and sort of the overall shift of a lot of our daily activities online. And, you know, two kind of important trends there are the fact, you know, that we've been discussing for the hour that there's just a lot of surveillance and data collection happening online. And so when you shift more parts of your life online that had previously happened in the real world, like school and work and others, then that's just increasing, right, the kind of digital footprint that's left behind, that's underprotected under current law. But we've also seen the expansion and creation of new systems for monitoring, you know, students at school, test proctoring, and in other circumstances, as well as people in the workplace, so-called bossware, right? So that's the result of kind of the shift where the pandemic has pushed a lot of our activities online. But then there's been, you know, a great deal of, you know, data collection and analysis about, you know, public health issues and the pandemic itself. There was a big push in 2020 to roll out these, you know, fancy systems for automated exposure notification, mm-hmm. what was kind of initially called digital contact tracing. And, you know, I think unfortunately it was kind of a little bit of tech solutionism, right? Folks thinking, oh, well, we can engineer our way out of this problem. But the reality is that a lot of time and energy and money was spent on those systems that probably would have been better spent, you know, just increasing the funding to the public health response, because at the end of the day, a lot of the systems are not even used. And when they are used, it's not clear that they're actually providing much of a public benefit. Luckily, a number of those digital contact tracing systems were, you know, designed in a pretty privacy protective way, especially when you compare them to the other things we've been talking about over the hour. But I think in terms of time and attention, it was probably better spent elsewhere. But we have in the last few months heard more about the types of location tracking the public health agencies have undertaken that really like goes far, I think, beyond what we knew before and what we thought was possible. So a lot of location data being collected and studied by the CDC and other entities to track people's movements and to see whether, you know, measure kind of compliance with stay-at-home orders, et cetera. It's, you know, the potential for, you know, the government to get involved in, again, every aspect of our daily lives, I think, is very real and very scary, especially given the lack of protections.
Well, I mean, the CDC might say, look, this is in the name of advancing science. This is in the name of trying to, you know, get over a pandemic. So, you know, you kind of have to also, I would imagine, balance those, you know, those privacy issues with also trying to, you know, understand the research and get ahead on the pandemic.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there are certainly a lot of, there's a need in public health for data, right? Especially mm-hmm. for data for research purposes, as you mentioned. And what's really, you know, needed is a more robust kind of legal architecture around that data, how it can be used, how it's going to be protected, rather than a system like we have right now, where there's really, you know, ambiguous or no standards. Yes, data can be used for good reasons, but where are the rules that say that it can only be used for good reasons, right? And how are those enforced? And especially when it comes to research data, you know, how are we ensuring that the research is ethical? How are we ensuring that, you know, the data is handled in a way that minimizes, you know, any ability to use it to re-identify people or to use it for improper purposes?
Yes. I want to touch on something as we have talked about this expansion of, you know, of surveillance and privacy in pandemic times. Also, in the geopolitical situation of the world, virtual private networks, especially in the Ukraine war, you're seeing more and more of this conversation around VPNs and about security and getting information. And I'm just wondering, from your privacy expertise background, the use of VPNs in these conflict areas like Russia, like Ukraine, are you going to see more of that come here stateside to the U.S. and using these in our daily lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that VPNs are, it's weird to think of, one more acronym entering the public parlance, but VPNs are probably pretty high on the list if you think about how often they come up in, advertisements and promotional things about privacy and security. I think there are a lot of, use cases where they can really provide, certain types of protection, especially if you're dealing with, government restrict or other external restrictions on internet use, that people are trying to get access to information. My biggest concern with VPNs is that it itself, the VPN kind of industry itself, is largely unregulated. And when someone is using a VPN to try to, improve the privacy of their internet browsing, for example, they're putting technologically, they're putting a lot of trust in the hands of the person operating that VPN.
Wow.
Because essentially they're handing over all their internet traffic, right? They're channeling it all through this VPN. And that is potentially protecting that data from some other third party, but it's potentially exposing a lot of that data to the VPN provider. So it's another situation, again, where I think it's really difficult for the average internet user to manage all of this stuff on their own. It's really complicated and the details matter. And it's part of the reason why we need robust privacy enforcement in the US to, for example, make sure that there aren't sketchy VPN providers out there that are just siphoning up a bunch of data and then selling it to brokers or governments.
We have about a minute left, and I want to circle back to Roe v. Wade and what could happen with digital privacy as you look ahead here. Is this, do you think, a turning point for new privacy laws? I mean, do you think there is enough momentum here that you will see some change?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that we've been on the cusp of, getting a real federal privacy law for a number of years. And what's needed is that spark, that impetus, right? There's a lot of, there's draft, there's bills, there's draft language, there's active negotiations in Congress over privacy law. And there's just, we never get over the hump, right? So we need the motivation. We need it to be feel real to people, to the constituents, and also to the lawmakers. And I think that this, potential loss of the protections in Roe and the reality of what, post-Roe surveillance could look like really does hit home for people in a way that these privacy conversations don't always. Sometimes it can feel very hypothetical, but this, I think, to people feels really concrete, feels, visceral.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Butler is Executive Director and President of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, which is based in Washington, D.C. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.